Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In May 2024, I spoke to Maxwell Stearns, the Venerable Bacher and Howard Professor of Law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. In his work, Professor Stearns applies the methodologies of economics, broadly defined, to study private and public law, along with institutional decision-making processes. In his new book, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing a Broken Democracy, Professor Stearns looks at how the solution to many of America's democratic challenges is to amend the Constitution, reforming the U.S. government to become a parliamentary democracy. We spoke about his new book, including why he thinks American democracy is in crisis, the lessons he has learned from how other countries govern, and what reforms are now needed in the U.S. Well, thanks so much for joining us at the Ballpark today. Could you start out by telling us a little bit about your academic background and interests and how they sort of connect to each other? Because I know you're interested in sort of constitutional law, economics, and politics. Thank you.
Well, first, thank you, Chris, so much for having me on your podcast. And so I'm a professor. I teach constitutional law and economics at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. So it's a state law school in the state of Maryland. And I have been interested for many years. Really, I've just finished my 32nd year of teaching. I've been interested for many years at the intersection of constitutional law, constitutionally established lawmaking institutions, and economic analysis broadly defined, by which I mean the tools of economic analysis that are used to study group decision making, which include social choice and game theory, but also traditional or neoclassical economics as well. So I kind of resided for a very long time where those two circles overlapped. And that got me very interested about 5 or 6 years ago and very concerned about what's happening to American democracy.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So your new book is Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Can you just give our listeners a kind of a brief overview of the book, what it's about, and what led you to write it?
Because of my unusual background that I've just described, most law professors who teach constitutional law don't use economic analysis. Most people who do economic analysis of law aren't thinking about constitutional law. So I'm a little bit unusual that way. For a period of time, beginning in the mid-teens, not my mid-teens, but the years, I became increasingly concerned that the United States is in a constitutional crisis. And I can explain what I mean by that. I don't mean just things are bad. I mean a constitutional crisis. And really, it's the third constitutional crisis in our history, as I explain in the book. That alone wouldn't have motivated me to write a book. But what I began to observe was more and more people were recognizing the crisis that we are in, and more people, serious people, commentators in the media, academics, were beginning to throw out ideas about how to get past the crisis that we are facing. And it became clear to me as a result of my somewhat unusual academic background that the vast majority of proposals that were being floated wouldn't, if they were enacted, solve the crisis, and they couldn't be enacted for the most part. And I began to really think deeply about this and realize that there was a solution, something that really would allow us to extricate ourselves from this crisis that could be enacted. And at that point, I realized that I had to write this book. It wasn't so much that I wanted to spend 4 years writing a book about how to fix American democracy. It's that I really felt that I had no choice but to write a book to explain why so many popular proposals won't work, can't be enacted, typically both, and how there really is a path forward that it would allow the United States to come out of the mess it is in as a genuine, thriving, legitimate multi-party democracy.
You start your book, Parliamentary America, with what seems to be an increasingly common refrain in a lot of books and media that have come out recently, that America and American democracy in particular is in a state of crisis. Can you talk about why you think American democracy is in crisis and why you see now as being a particularly dangerous moment? Thank you.
So first, let me go back to what I mean by crisis, because that's a term that does require definition. So what I mean by a crisis is when there is a fundamental disjuncture or divergence between the premises of the system under which we are operating and the vital needs of governance in society at the time. This is not the first time we've had such a profound divergence. Students of American history will know that the framers of the Constitution actually weren't supposed to be framing a constitution at all. They were supposed to be proposing revisions to the then governing document called the Articles of Confederation, which was failing in so many fundamental ways that they disregarded even its amending process to begin and start over. And that was the first crisis, superseded a constitution under which we were operating with a new one. The second crisis involved the period in the lead up to the American Civil War, in the aftermath, the period called Reconstruction, which tragically ended too soon. And that also resulted in three amendments to the Constitution that fundamentally redefined the relationship between the federal government and the states, although many of the goals of those amendments weren't honored for almost a century. Some might argue that they still haven't fully been honored. And the third constitutional crisis is the one that we are facing now. And what this crisis involves is a two-party system that we endured for over a couple of hundred years that really began to become fundamentally dysfunctional in what I'll call the information age, the period beginning roughly in the early 1990s. And a couple of very specific things happened in this period of our history that have caused the two parties that once considerably overlapped, and we can talk about that history, that considerably overlapped, to grow further and further apart to the point whereas if you go back a generation or two, people could imagine others with whom they disagreed reading and assessing common materials, but coming to a different resolution in good faith. Now, both as a matter of sort of our society and our governance, the general understanding is that people who hold fundamental disagreements with us, no matter what side we're on, either lack basic intelligence or they are evil. And this has caused a fundamental distrust in virtually every American governmental institution and across the divides with respect to our culture and society. We are a nation that is divided in profoundly problematic ways that is undermining our capacity for effective governance.
Thank you. And I'd just like to ask kind of a follow-up question, if I may. So the first two kind of breakpoints that you talk about are sort of just after the American Revolutionary War and the Civil War. And you're sort of describing this new breakpoint, whereas this is more of a kind of a civil conflict rather than a kind of anything military, or if you see what I mean. Those original conflicts were much more apparent to the population of the US as a whole. And especially following the end of the Civil War, it was a definitive outcome. How do you see a kind of the consensus about this break that you're talking about now kind of falling? Is there a consensus about this break now?
So I'll just make one historical modification. So the period that marked the transition from the Articles to the Constitution was not after the American Revolution. We actually operated under the Articles really until into the 1780s. And of course, you know, we think at the beginning of the United States is 1776. We operated really, you know, really from the early 1700s, 1780s to the late 1780s under this document, the Articles of Confederation, and superseded it with the Constitution in the late 1780s. But you are right that what we're experiencing today doesn't look like a civil war, notwithstanding that we had the events of January 6th that were very much what could have been a successful insurrection. It was an attempted insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. It wasn't successful. But I think there's a really important point to make about constitutional crises and the failures of democracy. And I'll refer to a book written by two extraordinarily thoughtful Harvard political scientists, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, called How Democracies Die. And the central sort of thesis of that book is many, many people think that democracies die in some spectacular fashion that we can recognize with a particular event, like the Civil War, right? Or maybe a military coup. And in fact, there's no doubt, because they go through lots of examples of former democracies that have suffered their demise in that way. But that's not even necessarily the most common manner by which democracies fail. Most of them fail through a process of the gradual erosion of longstanding democratic norms until it reaches a point at which there's no return. You've sort of hit the inflection point at which it becomes impossible to go back, you know, sort of figuratively putting the toothpaste back in the tube. Too much has been let out. And I think that what we are experiencing in the United States, even setting aside the events of January, the January 6th attempted insurrection that would have, for the first time in American history, have prevented the peaceful transfer of power from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. Even setting that aside, if that isn't good enough to persuade, let's set it aside. We are experiencing and have experienced the systematic degradation of longstanding, long agreed upon democratic norms. And it's vitally important that American citizens and also other observers outside the United States, just given the importance of the United States in the world, understand that what we're experiencing isn't normal. We can identify its root causes, but we should not imagine that what we're experiencing is normal. And I think that Ziblatt and Levitsky tell an extraordinarily important cautionary tale that really should cause Americans to be deeply reflective in terms of what is happening to our democracy and what's going to be required to set it on a better path.
Thank you so much for that. So your book begins by delving into the history of how the modern two-party system and constitutional balance in America came to be. What are the most important lessons that you've drawn from this historical analysis?
So in chapter three of the book, I give the history of the parties from the beginning to the time the manuscript locked. And there are a couple of really important things for people to understand. One thing that's vital to understand is that what the framers of our Constitution thought they were doing ended up conflicting fairly directly with what they did. So when people talk about, in an almost mythic sense, the brilliance of these men who met in Philadelphia and came up with a system that endured longer than other systems around the world in terms of a written constitution, we have to ask ourselves whether that endurance, the fact that we've operated under a single written constitution, more or less, for going on a quarter of a millennium, is because of the brilliance of the design or in spite of it. And what I try to convey to the readers is that it's in spite of it, and in fact, the scheme that the framers set up never operated the way the framers envisioned it to operate. The framers imagined that they were setting up what I call in the book a rock, paper, scissors constitution, a never-ending set of rivalries among three branches of government where each branch could defeat or be defeated by any other branch, and we would have institutional affiliations forming the jealousies of our nation's politics. It never played out that way. You can go back to George Washington's inaugural address. That's very early in our history, and he laments the rising partisanship. We have always ended up with two parties dominating in our system, and that's a consequence of what, not what the framers thought they did, but what they actually did. And they basically set up a system in which the president is chosen, admittedly filtered through the Electoral College, but directly by voters rather than through coalitions. Senators are chosen originally by state legislative bodies. Now it's by elections on a statewide basis. And they foreordained an eventual move in our lower legislative chamber, maybe analogous to the House of Commons. We can analogize the Senate to the House of Lords. There are differences, but there are similarities, where they inevitably foreordained a move towards single member districts. And when you have one person, whether it's at the district level in the House, state level in the Senate, nationally for the presidency, representing a geographical region, what happens is each side realizes that the successful strategy is to keep your side, your coalition intact and divide the opposition. The other side sees that too. And the natural outcome is to divide us into two teams, which become two parties. Now, I want to be clear, as with the UK, which also districts this way, we have additional parties. A two-party system doesn't mean there aren't third, fourth, or more parties. A two-party system means that third, fourth, or more parties play a confounding role in our politics. Meaning, if you vote for a candidate to the left of the Democrat, to the right of the Republican, our equivalent of a Labor and Conservative Party, you are throwing support in the direction of the major party candidate you least prefer. Or alternatively, you may be voting for a candidate who pulls support from both major parties, rendering the outcome a roll of the dice. So the first lesson of that part of the story that I tell is how we ended up with an entrenched two-party system. In periods of transition, we had more than two parties, but when the dust settles, we end up with two dominant parties. Not only do we have the oldest written constitution in the world, we also have the two oldest parties in the world. It's quite remarkable. The other part of that story has to do with the role, especially in the information age, that hyper-partisan gerrymandering, the manner by which districts are drawn, has affected our politics and enhanced the hyperpartisanship between two parties that once overlapped considerably, and we can talk about that, but that today are growing in a deeply problematic way, so far apart that we cannot that neither side can credit the other virtually ever as acting in good faith when achieving significant matters of disagreement.
Thank you. And I think, especially for our listeners who might not be so familiar with American political history, can you talk a bit about how the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have actually drifted apart in the last, 150 years or so, and how that, what implications that's had for American democracy?
Yeah, well, I don't think I'm going to go back that far. The Republican Party traces its origins to the demise of a party called the Whigs, which will sound familiar to you folks, in the lead up to the 1860 election, which resulted in Abraham Lincoln being elected. And he was the first Republican elected. And of course, we have the history of the Civil War. The Democratic Party is older. The Democratic Party traces its origins to a peculiar 1824 election that was not resolved by voters or by the Electoral College. It was one of two elections through a peculiar process we have in our Constitution. When the Electoral College fails, that sends the election to the House of Representatives, which with each state getting one vote, and an election in which Andrew Jackson got a plurality, meaning he didn't get a majority of votes, but he got more votes than any other candidate. Nonetheless, in the House of Representatives, lost to John Quincy Adams, the first of two presidents who were sons of prior presidents. Of course, the second example is, so John Quincy Adams was the son of John Adams. And of course, George W. Bush was the son of George H.W. So, but I think the more significant point is that if you go back to the 1950s, so we're not going back 150 years, back 75 or so, the parties, there was a study done by the country's, maybe the world's leading political science association, the American Political Science Association, did a study in the early 1950s. The major criticism of the two-party system at that time was that the parties were insufficiently distinct and didn't give meaningful choice to the voters. And in fact, in 1952, in the 1952 election, both the Democratic and Republican parties courted the same candidate. They both wanted Dwight D. Eisenhower to be at the top of their ticket. It is unimaginable to American voters today. I've spoken to audiences across the country. It's unimaginable to young people, especially, to think, wow, both parties want the same person, campaign, you know, the head of their ticket. That's just so remote. And at the same historical period, there was a book written by an economist named Anthony Downs. He published a book in 1957 called An Economic Theory of Democracy. And in that book, most people haven't heard of Anthony Downs, most people haven't heard of the book, but that book sort of lays out a conception of American politics that, although it's not accurate, is in the minds of almost every American voter. And it's this idea that we can imagine a single line left to right. And if we have a strongly liberal, call it a Democrat, Democratic candidate to the left, and a strongly conservative, call it a Republican candidate to the right, that over time, to get more and more support, they will converge on the center, or on what a political scientist calls the median voter, right? And at the time he was writing this in the 50s, that was probably somewhat descriptive of our politics. It is far less descriptive of our politics today. And that has a lot to do with what's happened in the information age. And I talked about one reason has to do with a particular story told in a wonderful book by David Daley, with the unceremonious main title "Rat Effed." "Rat Effed" translates to "a dirty deed done dirt cheap." And he tells the story after the first Barack Obama election in 2008 of Republican operatives realizing that if they throw money at state elections that are kind of below the national radar, people aren't paying so much attention to them, they can turn enough states in the U.S. we would say are red or purple, meaning that they're predominantly Republican would be red, purple would mean unclear, or blue would mean Democratic. So what they realized was if they throw enough money at states that are blue or purple, is what I should have said, they could flip those states and turn them red. And the way it works in the U.S. is state legislatures, or what we call general assemblies, do the districting maps for the contingent from the state to the United States House of Representatives. And so the concept was, get enough states red, those states will gerrymander their maps in ways that will make the House of Representatives entrenched as a Republican body. And they thought they had a lock on the House for 20 years. They actually didn't quite keep it for 20 years. But what they did do through this strategy, which is called red mapping, and I'll point out that the blue states, you know, Democratic states, blue map too. So we have red mapping and blue mapping. The consequence has been that for the House of Representatives, rarely is it the case that elections are competitive in the sense that either a Democrat or Republican can win. Rather than voters choosing their representatives in the House through hyperpartisan gerrymandering, the representatives are really choosing their voters with a minuscule number of districts that are actually competitive. Now, just to be clear, we have a two-phased election cycle. We have a primary slash caucus cycle followed by a general election. These can be competitive in the primary caucus cycle. If you are an incumbent Republican and you are insufficiently willing to placate the MAGA or America First base, you might be challenged in the primary by somebody who is willing to placate that base. And what the consequence, and that plays out on the other side too, although not quite as effectively, the consequence is to push the parties further and further apart. The other dynamic, which we can talk about, involves a really significant change in the manner by which we receive news and news-like information. And that too feeds into driving this wedge between the parties and between our culture.
So we've talked a bit about what you see as being the crisis of American democracy and the kind of the problems. In the book, you present a number of solutions, and those solutions draw inspiration from the electoral and governmental systems of several countries, particularly the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Taiwan, and Israel. Can you talk about why you chose to focus on those countries when reflecting on how the U.S. government and the U.S. system should change? And maybe talk a bit about what your main takeaways were from each in terms of what the U.S. should take away and what the U.S. should leave from their systems. Thank you.
So a centerpiece of this book is to take my readers on a virtual world tour and actually take them to seven countries. I take them to England, France, and Germany in Chapter 5, and I take them to Israel, Taiwan, Brazil, and Venezuela in Chapter 6. And I do this after explaining, providing some theoretical constructs that allow readers to understand and how to compare systems, how to see their strengths and their weaknesses, and how to compare them to our own and to each other. And also providing a background of how we got to the crisis that we are presently in. The premise of the world tour is there is no perfect democracy. That's demonstrable both at the level of theory. People have won Nobel Prizes for making that point. And, you know, as Winston Churchill famously said, that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been tried. It's also observable empirically. There is no perfect democracy. So the premise of the world tour is we are about to see several imperfect democracies. And what we're going to do is we're going to compare not the strengths of those systems against our weaknesses. We're going to compare the strengths and weaknesses of our system to the strengths and weaknesses of those systems. And we're going to think about how we can make our problematic democracy better. And I'll say this, not only is every democracy imperfect, every democracy embeds necessarily some anti-democratic features. And it is vital that readers understand this, that citizens, not just of the United States, but across the globe who are dedicated to democracy, understand there cannot be a perfect democracy, but that doesn't mean there cannot be a better democracy. So the goal is to make our democracy better with the understanding, going to Voltaire, that the enemy of perfect is the enemy of good, right? Once we recognize the impossibility of perfect, we can really focus on what can make democracy good or better. And so the reason I chose the countries I chose is because when you think deeply about the questions of democracy, you realize that they all embed choices along two democratic axes. One of those involves the manner by which you elect the lower legislative chamber. In the UK, that's, of course, the House of Commons. In Germany, it's the Bundestag. In the United States, it's the House of Representatives. Some countries only have a unicameral legislature. Israel's an example of that. The Knesset's a unicameral legislature. The second question, or the second axis, is how do you select and hold accountable the head of government? And when you and what I set up at the end of chapter six is a table. It's a 3x3 table, like a tic-tac-toe board, right? And what I demonstrate is that we can roughly divide the selection of head of government into systems that are presidential, hybrid, which would include semi-presidential, like France, or semi-parliamentary, like an experiment that Israel engaged in from 1996 to 2001, although that label's disputed, and parliamentary, which of course includes the UK, it also includes Germany, it also includes Israel. Then we have the second axis, which is how it is that we elect the lower legislative chamber. And the two endpoints there are we can do it with single member districts, which tends toward two parties. We can do it with pure proportional votes and no districts at all, like Israel, right? And we can do that. We can also find a hybrid. And the hybrid that I advocate for is called mixed member proportionality. One of the central lessons of the World Tour is that there are two alternative threats to democracy. They sound opposite, but they're the same threat. The first threat is when you have too few parties. Why? If you have a two-party system, there is a fundamental danger that if you give up any part of your constituency, you risk throwing power to the other side. The UK experienced that. It gave rise to Brexit, frankly. That's the story of Brexit. David Cameron being concerned about losing a constituency in his Conservative Party and throwing this out to the voters based on polling that revealed a 52% stay preference and a 48% leave preference that actually flipped almost precisely mirror image, 52% leave, 48% stay. And the price of keeping his coalition together in a two-party, basically a two-party system, was to have the EU fall apart. And similarly, so that's the danger in having too few parties. And we're witnessing that with Donald Trump. This conversation we're having is the end of May. Last night, Donald Trump was convicted on 34 felony counts. Okay. And yet he is heading a ticket for one of the two major parties. The opposite threat is when you have hyperfragmentation, where one kind of high valence leader, highly charismatic leader, can come in and get more seats than anybody else in the legislature and begin rolling over other parties one by one. That is the story, in fact, of Adolf Hitler in the rise of Nazi Germany. So how do you fight off those two competing threats of too few parties or too many? You have to achieve the Goldilocks principle. And most political scientists believe the right number of parties is somewhere between 4 and 8. And it turns out that the scheme that was created for Germany after World War II actually achieves this Goldilocks principle through mixed member proportionality, making a choice along two critical axes: how you elect the lower legislative chamber, the Bundestag, and how you select and hold accountable the head of government, they're the chancellor. Now, I want to say something here that's very important. The system that Germany has is very German. It's very complicated. And about a year ago, in March of 2023, Germany underwent a substantial modification of their system. We're still waiting for the first election cycle under the new MMP system. I am proposing a version of that system that is dramatically simplified in comparison with Germany's system, and that leads to the preservation of vital American institutions. So I'm not making a plug-and-play move. One should never do that. One has to be very contextual when thinking about any kind of major reform to a system of democracy. But it turns out that the MMP system, which I know we'll talk about, is eminently adaptable to be a beneficial system that we could adopt and that could gain political support in the United States.
Thank you so much for that. So your first proposal that you outline in the book is for doubling the size of the House of Representatives, where the new or additional 435 seats would be based on a list system and proportional representation. Could you talk a bit about how this might work for those who might not have not be so aware of what a mixed member proportional system is? Why you believe this strikes the right balance, and what would this do to the two-party system as it currently stands? Thank you.
Absolutely. So the thing that it would do to the two-party system is end it. It would, so I wanted to say, give the punchline up front, because the goal here is to create a genuine multi-party system. As I said, in a two-party system, we have third, fourth, and fifth parties, but you're punished for voting for them. This would create a system whereby when you support third, fourth, fifth, or more parties, you are rewarded for doing so, because you will actually get something in return for that support if the party successfully partakes in forming the government. And that's vitally important. Okay, so let's talk about mixed member proportionality. And I will mention how Germany does it and how I'm proposing we do it in the United States, because there are dramatic differences here that make this much more tractable in terms of modifying the system that we presently have and getting to where we want to be, which is a thriving multi-party system. So the way it works in mixed member proportionality is that when you are voting for the lower legislative chamber, and here I'll talk about the US, so every 2 years, we go in and we have a vote that includes elections for the House of Representatives. They serve 2-year terms. Everybody should know this. We have sort of weird calendars. The president serves a 4-year term with a 2-term limit. Members of the House serve 2-year terms, no term limit. Members of the Senate, our upper chamber, serve 6-year terms, no term limit. So people understand the calendar. So every 2 years, you would go in and you would cast 2 ballots for the House of Representatives. Right now, you cast 1 in a districted election, which is typically a product of a gerrymandered district. You'll cast 2 ballots. One of them will be in a district, exactly like you do now. And because it is one person representing that district, you will have 2 parties dominating that race for the reasons I previously explained, which is the goal is to keep your side intact, fracture the opposition, it's mutual, you end up with 2 dominant parties. The second vote is going to be by party. Now, what I then do, unlike Germany, is on a state-by-state basis, I use the party votes to determine proportional representation for the state delegation to the House of Representatives. So we double each state's delegation. If you have 2, you get 4. If you have 1, you get 2. If you have 10, you get 20. We go from 435 members to 870 members. Okay. You're going to cast 1 ballot in a districted election. You're going to cast 1 ballot by party. Now, in Germany, that's how it works too. The difference is that in Germany, they use the party balloting on a national basis to determine proportionality, and then they allocate those seats to each state, and it creates some mathematical problems. And those mathematical problems include the simple fact that you can't make the math work while maintaining a stable size legislative body if you're going to have pure proportionality. There are 3 pressure points in an MMP system. Number 1, every constituency seat winner, or for us it will be a district seat winner, is guaranteed to be seated. Number 2, you have party proportionality. The German Supreme Court has insisted on pure party proportionality. Number 3, you'd like to have a stable size legislative body. If you look at this closely, what you'll discover is you can guarantee any 2 of those 3 things. You cannot guarantee all 3. The German Supreme Court insisted on pure party proportionality. The original German MMP required constituency seating. Germany had a 598 originally numbered Bundestag that, in order to make the math work to achieve pure party proportionality, inflated to 736 members. In March of 2023, they revised their system. They put a cap on the Bundestag at 630 members. Again, there are three pressure points. Something's got to give. The German Supreme Court insisted on pure party proportionality. The voters decided on a fixed-size Bundestag. What gives is the constituency seating. So in Germany now, the constituency seat winners get priority in the party list, but they don't get guaranteed seating. That creates some interesting complexities we can talk about. In my proposal, I realized from the beginning, American voters are never going to stand for a variable size House of Representatives. That is a non-starter. So I knew we had to have a fixed size House of Representatives. And I also knew the only way you're going to get buy-in by members of Congress to actually get an amendment passed, there's two ways to get an amendment passed, but historically we've only done it through Congress, as opposed to the other way, which is to call a constitutional convention. The only way to get buy-in is to let the people in their districts keep their seats. So we have to keep constituency seating, or what I call district seating. There are three pressure points. The other pressure point is proportionality. And what I realized is we don't need pure party proportionality. We need what I call good enough proportionality. Good enough proportionality at the state level, so that in order for a party to form a successful coalition, they have to join forces with other parties. That's what we need. We don't need pure party proportionality. So I solved the problem that caused Germany to change its system in March of 2023 beforehand. I had figured out that that's not going to be a problem for us because we're going to have a fixed-size legislature. So what this amendment does is it makes it so that when you vote for a party in a state, the state proportionality based on the party votes is going to control the entire state delegation. So let's take a state like Washington State. Washington State has 10 members of the House of Representatives. So under my scheme, they get 20. So let's imagine my amendments get adopted, and now members of the Washington State electorate vote in the House of Representatives, and they cast two ballots, one by district, one by party. Imagine that the two parties that dominate the district races are the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I should mention, beneath our two major parties, there are easily five or six parties. The Democratic Party probably splits into what we have, a traditional sort of center left Democratic Party, but also a progressive party, which has stronger commitment to sort of stronger left values. The Republican Party splits between a traditional conservative center-right party and what we could think of as MAGA or America First. There's probably a Green Party, kind of an environmental party. There's probably a Libertarian Party. So we probably naturally have five to six parties embedded roughly within two major parties. So imagine that in the district races, the Democrats and Republicans are the dominant parties. And imagine that they split even. Democrats get five seats, Republican gets five seats. Everybody with me on this? So that's the idea. Okay, so now imagine that in the party votes, there are four parties that are the most significant in Washington State: the Democrats, the Progressives, the Republicans, and what we'll call America First. Imagine that those four parties each get 25% of the vote. Now, remember, Washington went from 10 to 20 seats. The Democratic and Republican parties already got their 25% through their district elections. The America First and Progressive parties have not gotten their 25%. So now they each pick up five seats. Washington sends 5, 5, 5, and 5 as their delegation to the House of Representatives. That's a lovely example. The math is beautiful. most states won't have beautiful math. This goes to the notion of good enough proportionality, right? And the goal is not to have each party perfectly represented. The goal is to make it so that no party is going to succeed in forming a coalition on her or his or on its own. So imagine, for example, that you are that Washington voter and that you are a progressive Democrat, that you're kind of or a progressive party member. Chances are what you'll do is in the district election, you'll vote for the Democratic candidate closer to progressive. And in the party list vote, you'll vote for the progressive party. Now, this time you won't be punished for doing so. It won't be a spoiler, because now through the second of my two amendments, the rule is that the way you form the government in descending order of representation in the House, up to five party leaders can negotiate on a fixed calendar until they achieve a majority coalition, at which point their pre-designated slate for president and vice president assume those offices. Imagine you are that progressive voter in Washington and you voted for the Progressive Party. Now the Progressive Party leader says to the Democratic leader or to the Republican leader, I'll join your coalition, but I'll only join your coalition if you give us certain policy concessions, if you give us certain cabinet appointments, maybe even if you appoint the first opening on the Supreme Court to one of ours. Suddenly, instead of being punished for voting for that party, you've been rewarded because that party is providing something of value to you. They're not going to get everything. That's called politics, right? And the idea is that effective politicians will prioritize what matters most to their constituents, and they will figure out ways to deliver on those most important commitments. And suddenly, you've got a thriving multi-party system in place of a really deleterious crisis-level two-party system.
Thank you so much. So you've mentioned this already in terms of your second proposal, which is that the president and vice president would go from being directly elected as they are now to one which is selected by a majority coalition vote in the House of Representatives. This is quite a big change. How would this change impact the U.S. government's effectiveness and the kind of checks and balances that we might be used to?
So I think it would improve our effectiveness and our system of checks and balances. One of the counterintuitions is that we get greater separation of powers, greater checks and balances by relaxing the formal separation between the head of the government and the legislature. The framers simply got that wrong. We will have greater accountability if a coalition is answerable to the head of the government. And the reason for that is what the framers fail to understand is that the president isn't just head of a branch of government. The president is necessarily the head of one of only two parties that can conceivably gain that office in the system we're presently under. And as a result, individuals in Congress aren't jealous based on their capacity as members of the House or Senate. Instead, Congress splits between those that back the president no matter what and those who oppose the president no matter what. If we want genuine separation of powers, genuine checks and balances, we are much better off in a system which a multi-party coalition is answerable, or the president is answerable to a multi-party coalition. Much more likely that somebody in that coalition will say, no, that's unacceptable for us, then when you have a system like we have observed over the last several election cycles, where no matter what Donald Trump says or does, his most ardent defenders will contort themselves to embrace verifiably indefensible propositions to maintain and hold power.
Thank you. So your third proposal is for a kind of supplemental mechanism for replacing the president according to the presidential line of succession. So this is instead of impeachment, which you note is effectively impossible in the current system. So you propose a 60% no confidence vote. Can you talk a bit about your reasoning behind this and why 60% as a number Thank you.
So I do want to clarify one thing, a potential ambiguity. Not instead of impeachment. I do not eliminate the impeachment clause. We also have another mechanism for removal, the 25th Amendment, which has never been deployed. So we have two mechanisms to remove a president. We have had several impeachment votes in the House of Representatives, but the way it works in the United States is that the House of Representatives votes to impeach, and then there's a trial in the Senate. We have never successfully removed a president through a Senate trial. We've had five impeachments, and we've never had a successful removal in the Senate. The only arguably successful example of the impeachment clause was the one that didn't happen. Nixon resigning his presidency rather than facing a likely successful impeachment. But even if we set that aside, I say to American audiences, you know, imagine that you went back to Philadelphia to the Constitutional Convention, tapped on the door and said, hey, you're working on this impeachment clause. I have a question for you. If this country that you're creating this constitution for lasts for a quarter of a millennium, do you think that there will never be a president who warrants removal under this impeachment clause? I think that the vast majority of folks in the Constitutional Convention would laugh at that idea and say, no, of course, American voters aren't going to get it right all the time, right? But in fact, precisely for the reason I previously explained, which is that the president isn't just the head of a branch of government, but is the head of one of only two parties that can assume that office, right? The impeachment clause is effectively gutted. There are other reasons why it's gutted, having to do with the 12th Amendment, which changed our Constitution to recognize parties. And it's sort of a bit of arcane American history. But we don't have an effective means of holding the head of our government accountable. So the First Amendment doubles the House and creates this mechanism for multiple parties. The Second Amendment really creates a system whereby third, fourth parties supporting them is rewarded. This last amendment holds the president meaningfully accountable through this mechanism of a 60% vote of no confidence for maladministration. Now, in the chapter in which I describe this, chapter 9, I am very careful to explain. I'm not giving a legalistic definition of maladministration, but rather I do give examples based on four recent presidencies of conduct that readers can decide on their own if they think it would warrant maladministration. I give arguments on both sides to show the kinds of things that I'm envisioning future Congresses being concerned with. And what I want to be very clear about is maladministration does not mean a simple policy disagreement. And the reason that matters so deeply is because of the fact that the House of Representatives serve two-year terms, the president a four-year term. What we do not want to have happen is have a non-presidential election cycle shift slightly the balance of power in the House, and then use policy disagreements to take out a sitting president based on policy disagreements. The goal here is to balance accountability with stability. The United States is the largest superpower in the world. It is the largest economy in the world. It's vital to Americans, but vital to the world that the United States be stable, that we can commit to an election on a calendar. I should mention on the Second Amendment, I avoid the problem that many parliamentary systems have of just cycling votes and never achieving a government or having the government break down. My system is a backstop so that we actually guarantee on four-year cycles, we will have a solution to the election or selection of the president and vice president on a fixed calendar. I also keep in place the existing line of succession, which with the exception of the vice president is determined by statute. The vice president is determined by the Constitution, including that quirky 12th Amendment. But it creates stability, and it also, but because it's 60%, unlike many parliamentary systems, most actually, which are 50% plus one, disallows simply plucking off one or two members of the coalition to have a sea change in the government. The United States cannot afford that kind of instability and the inability to signal to the world, you can count on us to be a stable government. What I want Americans to understand is we can have the upside benefits of a parliamentary multi-party scheme without the downside costs of governmental instability that plague many parliamentary systems.
So thinking about these reforms that you're proposing in your book, what do you see as being the path to acceptance and implementation of your proposed constitutional amendments? Why would the Democratic and Republican parties accept these if it would potentially come at the cost of their dominance of U.S. politics?
So there's sort of a two-part answer to this. I cannot say when. We are in a crisis, and one of the things that the Ziblatt-Levitsky book make plain is that crises can endure for very long periods of time, even decades. There's no way to it's not difficult once we've defined what a crisis means to say that we're in one. That's easy. What isn't easy is to predict with any degree of certainty what the inflection point is at which we suddenly are going to confront the choice either to allow ourselves to no longer be a democracy or to engage in the serious radical reforms that will prevent us from no longer being a democracy. I can't say when it's going to occur. One might have thought January 6th would have been a good candidate. One might have thought that the presumptive nominee of one of the two parties having been convicted of 34 felony counts would be a good candidate. One might predict sentencing in July. One might predict future convictions. It could be any number of things. I cannot say. I do not know. Here's what I do know. What I do know is that it's probably a mistake to ask the question, would the Democratic or Republican parties go along with this, as opposed to would particular decision makers who presently in our failing two-party system align with the Democratic or Republican Party go along with this to save our democracy and to create a pathway to gaining or assuming power in a more thriving system? One of the benefits of using economic analysis is it focuses on the incentives at the level of individuals as opposed to ascribing motivations to groups. The Democratic and Republican parties comprise subgroups, elected officials, constituents, people who actually wish they were not part of the Democratic Party because they're progressives, people who wish they were not part of today's Republican Party because they reject America First, people who rejected the earlier Republican Party that was elitist because they would have preferred to be America First, people who are centrist Democrats who are worried about the pull toward the left by progressives. Those subgroups which create those parties would thrive better, have more power, have more choices, be more rewarded in a system that didn't have gunshot, sort of shotgun marriages between groups that actually don't like each other all that much, but that are forced into coalitions by virtue of the structures of government that create a two-party system. So I think that it is very possible to get by. And the other thing that I will say is, as I said earlier, there are two ways to amend the Constitution. All of our amendments have come through Congress. Twice we've come pretty close to having a constitutional convention. That requires two-thirds of the states voting to have a convention. Then they float the amendments. They have to be ratified by three-quarters of the states. Our amending process is a crazy high bar, no question about it. Okay. But we've come within one or two states in the 60s and 80s of having a convention. Right now, we're at about 20 states. You need 34. We could hit that number because of the crisis we're facing. And imagine that the convention throws out proposals that have the consequence of disempowering sitting members of the House of Representatives or even the Senate. Many of the reform proposals that are out there, ranked choice voting, multi-member districts, term limits, their purpose and effect would be to replace sitting members of Congress with others. Try getting members of Congress to support amendments, the purpose of which is to render them unemployed. If that happens, my amendments become a critical pressure release valve. Members of Congress can say, you know what? We know you're working on that, but we got a plan. We have three amendments. It'll get us out of the crisis. Yours won't. We'll support it, not yours. And it will actually empower so many people. Us, we're no longer locked into a two-party system. You're no longer locked into making a choice between the lesser of two evils. Let's go back to that Second Amendment for a second. People ask, why would American voters give up voting for the president? They would give it up because they gain more power. You're not empowered by making a choice between two candidates you dislike. You're empowered by contributing to the choices that are ultimately going to determine who runs the government. You are far more empowered in the multi-party system I propose than in the system that we have. If you went to Germany and asked the voters, hey, let's cut the Bundestag in half and have the voters choose the chancellor, you're not going to get a lot of takers. That's not going to be a popular proposal. We just have to get past this idea of American exceptionalism that we can't learn from the experience and history of other nations. And I think we can, because I think we're in crisis, and I think growing numbers of Americans are seeing it.
Thank you so much for that. It just remains for me to ask, as we end, do you have any other projects coming up or any other resources you'd like to point our audience towards?
Well, certainly, look, one thing I will mention, the book's going to be coming out. When this airs, it will be out as an audiobook. That's nice. I'll be narrating it. It's available on all of the usual sites. You can buy the book in all the usual sites. I have a blog called Blindspot Blog, www.blindspotblog.us. I have a post there that links to all of the talks that I have given. I do have some follow-up related projects. I'm going to be a little bit coy because I'm not precisely sure of the form they're going to take, but I assure you that I'm keeping busy. But my biggest goal, and I'll be honest, my biggest goal, really, we are in crisis here in the United States. My biggest goal is to talk to as many audiences and as many varied audiences as possible to explain why the proposals that are getting the most press will not work, cannot be enacted, or both, and why the system that I propose will work, can be enacted, and would allow us to produce something of vital significance. The dedication of my book is very simple: to my children and yours. This matters. If you believe that the project of American democracy deeply matters, as I do, buy this book, read this book, think about it, because we really need to undertake radical change if we're going to guarantee that future generations get to live in a thriving democracy called the United States.
Maxwell Stearns, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark this afternoon.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Maxwell Stearns is the Venable, Becher, and Howard Professor of Law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Maxwell Stearns for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On Twitter and Instagram, we're LSEUS, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.